My name is Bob Voiles, principal in the Seven Oaks Company, and I'm a member of the Real Estate Prayer Breakfast Steering Committee. This morning, as we transition to our lead speaker, I have the privilege and honor of introducing Mr. Tom Douglas. Now, throughout history, songwriters have held a special place in Western culture. From the troubadours in medieval Europe to Francis Scott Key, penning what became our national anthem while sitting aboard a British prisoner of war ship in Baltimore Harbor, songwriters capture the emotion and often the visceral reality of our lives. And in a world before iPods, MP3 players, CDs, and even the radio, songs were the primary way in which stories were told, culture and values were preserved, and passed from one generation to the next. Songwriters paint pictures with words and combine them with music to make memories which capture both special and ordinary moments, framing them with feelings of love, anger, humor, and reverence. In fact, the number one song of all time did not come from Nashville. That may be a surprise to some of us. But it was penned by the Hebrew leader Moses in the book of Deuteronomy over 3,500 years ago. It's called the Song of Moses, and it was to celebrate the crossing of the Red Sea. Well, why is that the number one hit? Well, if you know the Bible and you look at the book of Revelation, it says that this very same song, the Song of Moses, will be sung in heaven by the angels at the end of time. How's that? So like King David, who penned most of the Psalms, and Francis Scott Key, and many others, our speaker today comes from an honorable tradition. Tom, or Tommy, as his friends know him from his early days, he and I first met in 1972 when I was an undergrad at University of Virginia, and Tommy was kicking around GSU and Oglethorpe. He was best friends with one of my college fraternity brothers, Jim Wilson. They both had grown up in Atlanta and attended the Lovett School. Both wannabe musicians and barroom piano players, and the definition of a barroom piano player is the more people drink, the better you sound. I instantly liked Tom and began quietly rooting for his achieving his dreams in music. As his bio indicates, after a brief career in advertising, Tom moved to Nashville the first time, trying to make a go as a songwriter. Well, it did not work out. So like me, we eventually followed our mutual friend Jim Wilson into the wonderful world of commercial real estate. Tom moved to Dallas, where he began a 13-year career with some of Dallas's most notable real estate firms. I stayed up with him through Jimmy and through many of his other Atlanta friends who are here today. Sorry about this. Working hard at his career, Tom kept hearing an inner voice that was pushing him to pursue another shot at songwriting. Upon hearing Tom might be rebooting his music passion, I remember thinking, this is 20-something years ago, I sure hope he doesn't quit his day job. Well, while I don't want to take anything away from his story, which you're about to hear, I want to emphasize that like many of us here, Tom began his journey heading down one path, but like the Apostle Paul on the road to Damascus, the Lord picked him up and put him on a different journey that was an entirely different course from where he was heading. And only after some pain, setbacks, and disappointments could Tom fully begin to utilize the unique talents and skills that only God could have given him. And we call those things experience. So in 1994, Tom had his breakthrough hit with a song called Little Rock, sung by Colin Ray. It's a simple story of an alcoholic trying to make it through just the next day. Little Rock became a number one hit and was nominated for Country Music Association Song of the Year. That was followed by a string of multiple hits through many of Nashville's most famous country artists. And here's just a partial list: Randy Travis, Leanne Womack, Trisha Yearwood, Tim McGraw, Miranda Lambert, Brooks and Dunn, Blake Shelton, and my personal favorite, George Strait. His songs have been number one hits and have been featured in many Hollywood movies. And a sought-after songwriter, Tom's unique skill set has allowed him to win almost every award that one can receive in his field. And in 2014, Tom was inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame. In short, to quote a good friend of mine from Tyler, Texas, Tommy, you are now a bona fide rock star. Married for 32 years to the love of his life, Katie, and father to three beautiful grown children, Tom lives outside of Nashville, which has been his home this time for nearly 20 years. In studying up on him for this intro, I came across a number of very interesting quotes. This one by Leanne Womack, I think, sums up Tom the best. Tom's great at taking a snapshot of real life and putting it in a song. He's not afraid of writing about the hardships or the beauty of the world. In my opinion, that's what makes a true artist. Well, I looked up another person who I thought might have something to say about Tom, and King Solomon in the book of Proverbs says this a different way. Do you see a man skilled in his work? He will stand before kings. He will not serve among ordinary men. So like each of you, I look forward to hearing Tommy's story today. So let's all give it up for Mr. Tom Wilson. Douglas.
Well, good morning, good morning. I'm really delighted to be here, and Michael, thank you for that touching tribute to your son. I have always been attracted to famous people. I think that's part of my allure for doing what I do. I'm always interested with famous people. Are they really like we are, or are they completely different? Only to find out, honestly, they have all the insecurities and the foibles that most of us have. But, I do like rock stars. But look at this morning on a Friday morning in Atlanta. You got 1,350 people here. You guys are the rock stars. Let's just give yourselves a hand for at least being here. That's great. It's really amazing. If I'd really known how significant this was, I certainly wouldn't have accepted speaking to you this morning. But I'm delighted to be here, and it's great to be back home. It's like the prodigal returns, and Atlanta has, people talk about how much Atlanta's changed, and Atlanta has changed a lot, but it's still really the same to me. I've got all these pictures in my mind, and they're black, and they're white, and they're blue, and it's in a folder that I look at from time to time. And it's called My Atlanta, and it's Miss High School's kindergarten. And it's brown bag lunches with cream cheese and olive white bread sandwiches with the crust cut off at Morris Brandon. And it's third grade with Miss McGinnis with her beautiful red hair. And it's meet John, Paul, George, and Ringo gathered around a TV on a Sunday night with my father. And it's getting on a yellow school bus and going to see the Beatles at Atlanta Fulton County Stadium, August the 18th, 1965. How many of you were there? I mean, did I dream that, or did we actually do that? We can actually still hear the girls screaming in our ears. It's something that never goes away. And it's bomb shelters in rich people's backyards. Do you all remember that? And it's duck and cover drills in case the Russians drop the big one. And it's hearing the teachers, weep in the bathroom when John F. Kennedy was assassinated. And it's listening to my steel salesman father and my interior decorator mother on trips from Georgia to Louisiana in the summer when I was down on the floorboard and my sister was lounging on the back seat. And that was before air conditioning and seat belts and satellite radios and Corinthian leather. And somehow we survived. And it's the Varsity with a glorified stake and a ring one and an FO, and I'm sure you all know what that is. I don't have to explain that. And seeing Mr. Frank Gordy walk through and pick up the trash from the floor. And it's Georgia Tech when it was still Bobby Dodd and still in the SEC. And it's the Falcons. It's Tommy Nobis and Norm Van Brocklin. This is all my Atlanta. And it's busing and it's segregation. And it's Jewel who was the help. And Jewel came and helped my mother clean her house on Wednesdays. And she made the best fried chicken you've ever tasted. And she loved me and I loved her. At 3018 Argonne Drive, and it's Dr. King at Ebenezer Baptist Church, and it's black and white pictures of Selma and Little Rock and Birmingham as they flickered on the TV screen, and it's Lester Maddox and axe handles at the Pickrick Restaurant, and it's Neil Armstrong walking on the moon, and one day Jewel just stopped coming as a shot rang out from the gun of a madman on a dreadful spring day on a balcony outside a second floor of the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, Tennessee. And it's Henry Hank Aaron, always and forever the home run king, without an asterisk by his name. And it's smoking cigarettes and drinking Cokes in my basement with Jim Wilson and Debbie Roach as they sang like angels. And it's love it or leave it, and we raise more hell and we have more fun because we're the class of 71. Clark roomed right across the hall from me. And then it's off to the University of Georgia because isn't that just what you do? And then it's finding an out-of-tune piano at the bottom of the dorm where I hid out. And it's wacky weed outside the girls' dorm and an evening spent courtesy of the Athens Police Department. And they thought we were stealing radios out of cars. They didn't know we were just stupid. And being overwhelmed and leaving University of Georgia never to return, finding solace, flying high with the stormy petrels at Oglethorpe, impressing the girls at the SAE house, playing Your Song and Benny and the Jets, and mercifully, a soft place to land. And I got my first job from an advertisement outside the career counseling office. It was with a Quadell Management, and they managed low-income apartments in Atlanta, and it was $12,000 a year. It looked pretty good to me, and I couldn't pass the test for IBM anyway. So it was managing low apartment income properties in Atlanta, and I had no idea where South Atlanta was. And it was a tough neighborhood. I had a bully for a boss and crooked contractors, and it was high unemployment. You look up deferred maintenance in the dictionary, and you see this apartment complex. And my mother still made my lunch. But at least I ate the crust by now. They told me to get our monthly income up. Did I tell you I was a people pleaser? So I would walk around the complex late Friday afternoons, and it was mid-October, and I had my oxblood Ouijans on and my Egyptian cotton blue Oxford cloth shirt from H. Stockton at Lenox Square and my perfectly pressed khakis. Knock, knock, unit number 703. Mrs. Watkins, I'm here about your late rent. It looks like you're dressed a little early for Halloween. No, ma'am, I've never heard of a Muslim. Why don't I come back a little bit later about that late rent? And it was consistently trying to decide if I should be the preeminent John Portman or Jackson Brown. Oh, doctor, my eyes. All the while, Tumbleweed Connection was drifting over the tinny speakers of my Toyota Corolla. Fire and rain was pouring down the inside of the windows, and I got lost on a thunder road, and I got stained from blood on the tracks trying to climb to the top of Stone Mountain on a stairway of heaven, wafting down the echoes of the halls of Georgia State, where I matriculated because I had no earthly idea of what else to do. Selling television advertising for Channel 46, meeting Ted Turner, baseball and old movies, that'll never work. I think that's worked pretty well. And it's playing piano in the production offices of Channel 46. Conflicted and miserable, my mother gave me a copy of The Power of Positive Thinking by Norman Vincent Peale, which just shows God has a sense of humor considering I'm such a Reformed Presbyterian at this point. But honestly, it was the first time I had ever connected the historical Jesus with trying with a savior trying to save, saving a kid who was barely surviving grad school finance. And I knelt there on a green shag carpet, and God gave me the faith to believe, and Jesus loves me, this I know. And I ran away from home at age 27 and crisscrossed the country. That's funny, and it's sad, and it's true. Yeah, it was like, where are you going? My mother said, I'm running away from home, and this time I didn't come back. But I crisscrossed the country in a Dodge van playing the piano in coffee houses. I fell in love with the writers and the players in Nashville and Hank Williams and Johnny Cash and the Mount Rushmore-like faces of those staring down from the Opry stage and the girls and boys who make the noise on 16th Avenue. And after a four-year odyssey, leaving never to return. Go west, young man, with the love of my life, Katie, an Ole Miss co-ed, starting over yet again in Dallas, 1984, with a blue suit and a red tie, trying to leave the poet's clothes behind in the garbage can of a Chick-fil-A in Little Rock. I got a job with Hank Dickerson, story at Old Firm, a draw of $24,000 a year. My first question was, you mean I really don't have to pay this back? And they were like, no, it's a draw. 31 years old, finally retail leasing and sales. I could do this. I had a job. I had a career, and I was going to leave the melancholy ghost of the songwriter behind me somehow for the last time. Big D, it was blowing and going. You were flipping land. You could double your money simply on an appraisal. Easy street until the Tax Act of 1986 and paying tax on phantom income and interest rates of 21%. And the savings and loan crisis, foreclosures and bankruptcy, wow, this is a little harder than it looks. But one of the benefits of never making any money is you don't have to worry about all that legal stuff. Me, I was trying to lease a 1,000-square-foot dry cleaner space to Mr. Patel and his 6 family members. All the while, you two, and I still haven't found what I'm looking for, watching my dreams burn down, Bon Jovi and me living on a prayer. Why, Lord, why have you given me this passion for words and music only to have me frustrated and disappointed? I was cold calling a shopping center on a hot August day, and I was having this dual conversation with a prospective tenant and also with God. And I heard a still, small voice whisper, you are worshiping the creation, not the creator. How's that working out for you? And I wept on Interstate 635, and I surrendered yet again. And I said, Lord, I do need you more than the songs and the big cigars and the motor cars. And it was 1992, and Bill Clinton was running for president, and it was Little Rock this, and it was Little Rock that. Every time I heard that, I thought, that boy's on a roll. And it was a Saturday morning with a grand piano at SMU and a black and white composition book. And I sat down and I told the truth and the whole truth for the first time. It's autobiographical. It's starting over. I simply chose Arkansas as the setting. And you see, like the protagonist in the song, I am recovering, but not from whiskey, but from everything else. And it's a metaphor, and I'm going to play it for you. Well, I know I've disappeared a time or two, and along the way I lost me and you. I needed a new town for my new start, selling VCRs in Arkansas. And I haven't had a drink in 19 days. And my eyes are clear and bright without that haze. I like the preacher from the Church of Christ. Sorry that I cried when I talked to you last night. And I think I'm on a road here in Little Rock. I'm solid as a stone, baby, wait and see. And I got just one small problem here in Little Rock. Without you, baby, I'm not me. And I don't know why I held it all inside. You must have thought I never even tried. You know your daddy told me when I left, Jesus will forgive, but a daddy don't forget. And I think I'm on a road here in Little Rock. Solid as a stone, baby, wait and see. Got just one small problem here in Little Rock. Without you, baby, I'm not me. And lying here upon this motel bed, thoughts of you explode inside my head. And I think I'm solid as a stone, baby, wait and see. Got just one small problem here in Little Rock. Without you, baby, I'm not me. And I think I'm on the road.
Thank you.
Well, it was the first time that it was really honest and it was good, and I didn't care for the first time what anybody else thought. And I tried to give the song away. I sent it to publishers and I sent it to anyone, anywhere that would listen, and no one would take it. And I reconnected with an old friend at a songwriting seminar in Austin, Texas in the summer of 93. And he signed me to Sony Publishing. And I thought to myself, wait, do you really think that there might be a sovereign plan for my life, no matter how I've tried to screw it up? Do you think that Romans 8:28 could actually be true? And it says, and we know for those who love God, all things work together for good. Sometimes that's hard to believe, but that's true. And Colin Ray did record it, and it went to number one, and hundreds of thousands of people responded to a 1-800 number at the end of the video and called Al-Anon and Alcoholics Anonymous. And that summer, I used a payphone to call in for my messages and found out that I'd been nominated for Song of the Year. And Katie and I sat in back of Merle Haggard at the CMA Awards, and Alan Jackson floating down the Chattahoochee beat me, but it didn't matter. For the first time, I was relieved, and I was hooked, but enough is never enough. I was just another 20-year overnight sensation. But I wasn't about to trust the fickle music business again. I did keep my day job in Dallas and travel back and forth to Nashville 1 week a month. And I did that for 4 years. I'd finally found my footing in retail leasing, and I wasn't about to give it up. 3 children, my first house. I trust you, Lord, but come on, it's show business. There I was, the song broker, the real estate writer. Yeah, that's what they call me. I'd finally learned to survive failure. Could I survive the catastrophe of success? So says Tennessee Williams in a brilliant essay. The pressure builds and I need a drink. And it was 1997. At the ripe old age of 45, I quit my job, sold my house, moved my wife and my children back to Davidson County, Tennessee. Music City, where many are called and few are chosen. So let's make a deal. Superstar A is getting ready to record, and you've got 2 months, and you've got to have a song. You've had hits together. You've had dinner at their house, and you've got a picture on your desk of you and Tim McGraw and Carrie Underwood and Pink, and it's in a silver frame, and it's one of your prized possessions. But you start thinking, that was a long time ago. Maybe I should put that photograph up. Because desperation hangs on you like an odious cologne. And if you miss the recording cycle, you pay the price. The opportunity costs are expensive. The time value of money, and you want the money now. Add another 12 months to the 1.5 years before they record again, and that's a long time. And provided money can earn interest, any amount of money is worth more the sooner that it is received. You guys know that. The clock is ticking, and you've got to be good, and you've got to be creative. Music has an urgency to it. Maybe you can relate. The big tenant is moving, and they need space, and you've got a new project coming online, and you need an anchor, and the lender's getting antsy, and the partners are getting impatient, and you miraculously get the listing, and you beat out one of your old fraternity brothers, and he's not doing well, and he's lost his confidence, and it's bittersweet. And there's a crisis in the Middle East, and you're nervous, and the tax law is as stable as water, and the election is coming, and the talking heads keep talking, and I'm exhausted, and it's 8:53 on a Tuesday morning, and my mother has a headache and won't go to the doctor, and she got me and my father confused last week, and the space bar on my computer has stopped working. Do you have any idea how annoying that really is? And the young guns are moving in, and they're smarter, and they're faster, and they don't have arthritic knees, those cocky SOBs. And you got to stay relevant. My reputation is on the line, and you got to close. You got to make the sale, the closer. Didn't they used to call me the closer? And the needs, what are they looking for this time? Are they going more pop, more traditional, more R&B? Are they using an L.A. guy for a producer? That's a terrible mistake. Are they looking uptown, midtown, downtown, suburban? Isn't there a new CEO who's a Sierra Club guy, and doesn't he ride his bike to work and only wear hemp clothing? And before you hear a song on the radio, here are the steps that must happen. Number one, you have to write it. I write about 100 songs a year, so every 3 days I'm finishing a song. And you have to demo it, which is almost make a record to show people what the song sounds like. And then you present the song to the publisher, who in essence is the broker for the writer, who in this case is the developer. Sound confusing? So am I. And the publisher has to play the song for the record company and the record producer and the artist and the artist girlfriend and the artist's wife and the bus driver and anybody else that might have an inroad to Superstar A. And the song goes on hold, which means they like it as well as about 60 other songs. And if it makes it through that process and it's recorded, they always record more than they actually put on the album. And if it makes it on the album, you go to Walmart or a Target on a Tuesday morning and you buy a couple of copies for your wife and your astonished mother-in-law. And then miraculously, after they've released 2 singles, which has taken 36 months to go up the charts, they might release your song, and then you sweat out the chart position every week. Sound familiar? Maybe it's the same for you. If you build it, maybe they will come. Then you have to try to lease it, and there's a letter of intent, and then the escrow, and then the money's hard, and then on the day of closing, the broker gets nicked for some environmental survey that nobody else would pay for. Why didn't we go into high tech or healthcare? And they say grown men don't cry. So I was supposed to get donuts for my son's 3rd grade class, and I was supposed to get them the night before, which I had forgotten to do. So I dropped him off at school and was going to race to Harris Teeter and be back before the school bell rang. as I parked my car, I raced in to get my Krispy Kreme donuts, I noticed a woman talking on a payphone. Yes, they used to have such things like that. This was 2000. A woman was talking on a payphone. She was clearly distressed, and she had mascara tears running down her face, and her little boy was weaving himself in and out of his mother's legs, and together they looked like an ice cream cone that was melting. But I had to get the donuts. So I raced in. I got 2 dozen donuts instead. I raced back out, and there they were sitting in this vacuous, empty, windswept parking lot in a rusted red Malibu. And I noticed newspapers and Chef Boyardee cans all in the car. And I knew they were, you know, immediately homeless, and they just had this vacant stare. And I thought, well, I could give them $10, and I could tell them where the Union Mission is. I can wish them well. And I did nothing. And I got in my shiny black Suburban with my 12 donuts, and I drove to school, and I was haunted. And I vowed, I can never do that again. And the only thing I could do is write about it. And Tim McGraw recorded this. It's Grown Men Don't Cry. I need a roadie up here, actually, to assist me with the lyrics. But I should have put that in my rider, my contract with these guys. I pulled into the shopping center and saw a little boy wrapped around the legs of his mother. Like ice cream melting, they embraced years of bad decisions running down her face. A morning I've been thinking my life so hard, and they wore everything they owned, living in a car. Wanted to tell them it would be okay, just got back in my Suburban and I drove away. Now I don't know why they say grown men don't cry. Now I don't know why they say grown men don't cry. Keep having this dream about my old man. I'm 10 years old and he's holding my hand. Talking on the front porch, watching the sun go down. But it's just a dream. He was a slave to his job and couldn't be around. So many things I want to say to him, but I just put a rose on his grave and I talk to the wind. Now I don't know why they say grown men don't cry. Now I don't know why they say grown. Stairs and off to bed, my little boy says I haven't had my story yet. And everything weighing on my mind disappears just like that when he lifts his head off the pillow and he says, I love you, Dad. Now I don't know why they say grown men don't cry. I don't know why they say grown men don't cry. Well, you're very kind. Thank you. The work that we do is hard, as you all can attest, but it is good, and it's very difficult to keep that perspective. Catherine Alsdorf of Redeemer Presbyterian Church in New York says, the gospel story of work says that we're made to work, and the reason we're made to work is to do the work that God would have us to do, to help the world flourish. Apart from doing that kind of work, we're not fully human. We're not living the lives that God meant us to live. She goes on to say in her book, Every Good Endeavor, Connecting Your Work to God's Work, we would also define work as pre-fall. God gave us work to do before there was sin, before man sinned. He gave us work to do to contribute to human flourishing. He gave us work to do to create beauty, to create, to be creators in his image. Work in itself is good, but there's no question sin has changed the nature of work. If our expectation is that everything should be hunky-dory, we know that's an inadequate view of the fall. That sin, an inadequate view of the fall, that when sin came into the world, we became sinful and the world became broken. But God has called us to this extremely broken world. Martin Luther says that our hearts are idol makers, and for some of us that's monies, for some power and some security. Work can certainly become that. What I'm talking about is perspective. We live in the tension of God honoring work and worshiping at the altar of the all-consuming job. Our work does have an eternal value. We are healers of the broken. We redeem the destroyed. We are the hands and the feet of Christ. I'm sure you know that employed people, 25 to 54, who live in households with children under 18, spend an average of 8.9 hours working or in work-related activities, 7.7 hours sleeping, 2.5 hours doing leisure, and so forth. But they occupy the spaces that you lease, the buildings that you build. They spend more of their lives in your buildings than they do their own homes. They spend more time with their coworkers than they do their own families. In the environments that you create, and I don't use that term lightly, creation, the first verse of the Bible, in the beginning, God created. It's in our DNA. It's in your DNA. That's why you do what you do. It's a product of invention or imagination, a cause to exist, something that wasn't there before. I start with a blank sheet of paper and an emotion so powerful that it drives me to try to wrestle the music and the words down and hopefully create an opportunity for the listener to have a shared journey with me. And most of my songs are metaphors. Music is metaphor, so said Leonard Bernstein. And our friend Socrates said, man's greatest creative act is the ability to see one thing as another, and that's metaphor. And don't you want to slap somebody in a speech when they quote Socrates? But when we talk about metaphor, it's stop and smell the roses. And what does that really mean? That doesn't mean stop and open up your olfactory senses to drink in the aroma of the red rose. What it really means is stop, enjoy life, slow down. When the Bible says Jesus is the cornerstone, obviously the biblical writers aren't saying the second person of the Trinity is the stone upon which the temple is built, but he is the foundation upon which the gospel is built. And most of my songs are about home. I think home is the most powerful four-letter word in the English language, and it's getting lost and trying to get back home. Home where we remember who we are. After suffering from the assault of the cultural amnesia terrorists that attack us at every corner that we turn and the media that tries to get us to forget who we are and where we're from and to whom we belong, that we're made in the image of God, that we are born to reflect his glory, that we are to redeem his creation until his return. I do that with art and songs, and you do that with the beautiful buildings that spring forth from the imagination of your beautiful minds. What you do has a real glory to it, not in and of itself, but it's a reflection of a noble calling. You are the dream builders. Your buildings are metaphors too. They aren't just elevators and concrete and steel. You build the homes away from home so that God's image bearers can make a living, can find their fulfillment in their blood, sweat, and tears. They make a life while making a living to get married and buy groceries and have 1 week in Destin a year. That's what you do. You are the dream builders. We went out looking for our careers and we found our vocations, our true callings. It's not by accident that we are all here together this morning, and it's not by chance that your skill set and talent and gifts allow you to do the amazing things that you do, to manage and build buildings in this magnificent city, the capital of the South, the land of the free, and the home of the braves, that life has finally found us, and we need look no further. So let's walk in that truth today. And before the foundation of the world, it was predestined that a man would recall 3018 Argonne Drive some 50 years later and think back with gratitude for the friends and the family where I first learned about love and forgiveness. And as I close our time together this morning with the house that built me, it's good to be back home with you.
I know they say you can't go home again. I just had to come back one last time. Ma'am, I know you don't know me from Adam, but these handprints in the front steps, well, they're mine. Those stairs in that little back bedroom is where I did my homework and learned to play guitar. And I bet you didn't know under that live oak, my best dog's buried in. Thought if I could touch this place or feel it, the brokenness inside me might start healing. Out here it's like I'm someone else. Thought that maybe I could find myself. If I could just come in, I swear I'll leave. Won't take nothing but a memory from the house that built me. Well, Mama cut out pictures of houses for years, from Better Homes and Garden magazines. Plans are drawn, concrete poured, nail by nail, board by board. Daddy gave a life to Mama's dream. Thought if I could touch this place or feel it, the brokenness inside me might start healing. Thought that maybe I could find myself. If I could just come in, I swear I'll leave. I won't take nothing but a memory from the house that built me. You leave home, you move on, you do the I got lost in this old world and I forgot who I am. Thought if I could touch this place or feel the brokenness inside me might start healing. But here it's like I'm someone else. Thought that maybe I could find myself. If I could walk around, I swear I'll leave. I won't take nothing but a memory from the house that
Thank you. It's been a joy being with you.